This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report for June 30th, 2008, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Later on Building Bridges, George Carlin on The American Dream. But first,
State of the Unions with Pulitzer Prize nominee, author Philip Dine. How can unions regain their strength, empower the working class, and regain political influence? Veteran reporter Phil Dine, a two-time Pulitzer Award nominee, draws from his extensive experience.
Analyzing workers, organizing, contract, and electoral campaigns to draw lessons on how labor can revitalize itself. Now, the State of the Unions with author Philip Dine.
Hi, great to be with you.
The labor movement has really been decimated, and there's a great deal of cynicism amongst the working class even about organized labor. Why don't we begin by just perhaps a refresher on the indispensable, as you put it, part of the history and fabric of the United States that the organized labor movement is. What does it really mean?
You know, labor in the United States is qualitatively different than it is in most other countries. In France and Italy, for example, it's a revolutionary movement that tries to, for the most part, it's a divided movement, but the largest part is radical, wants to overthrow the system. In Germany, Sweden, it's not that radical, but it really wants to reform things. Here in the United States, labor has pretty much, with some notable exceptions, been centrist, moderate, middle of the road, and doesn't really want to drastically change, or it doesn't even really criticize the system. It simply wants to expand it, to open it up to more people, to increase the middle class, let millions of more people into it. And that's really what its function has throughout our history. It's integrated millions of people into the middle class. It's bridged ethnic and racial and religious divides. It's brought in generation after generation of immigrants. And even today, it's really trying to let more people share the pie.
Phil, you know, I was reading your book over the weekend and reading the newspapers and watching the TV news shows, and they were talking about the political campaign, and I was reading your analysis of the political campaign, labor's contribution in 2006 and 2004, and somehow it seemed to be deja vu all over again, that labor seems to get to do the work of political campaigns, the phone banking, but doesn't seem to set the agenda in any kind of way. Could you bounce off that?
I think that's right. I think that labor, for far too long, has been sort of a, and I say this respectfully, a gopher, primarily for the Democratic Party, in terms of doing just what you said, the logistical work, phone banks, the canvassing, the door knocking, the getting out the vote, and also preaching to the converted, you know, its own members. And it does that well. You know, if you ask labor how it did in the last election, it'll tell you, well, we had 3 million person-to-person conversations and knocked an X number of doors and 20 million pieces of literature. And that's all great. But when you ask them, what issues did you influence? You know, to what extent did you really get a bounce from the election? Or to what extent did you really shape the debate? Sort of a silence there, because they don't do that. They spend, in my view, a lot too much time trying to elect candidate X, and far too little time trying to let people know what labor's issues are so they can get behind them, so that when they, quote, win an election, there's actually a mandate. And they also spend far too little time letting the people know, not just during elections, but year-round, why labor still matters.
You frightened me terribly when I broke open the book and I saw Chapter 1, Dead Man Walking. That was a rather ominous title there. But it's absolutely true. And you point out, certainly in the introduction, that there's an ever tougher time, as you say, holding its own in collective bargaining with employers. And labor's proven utterly incapable of stemming the flight of good jobs overseas. And it endures crushing political defeats, including the 2004 presidential election, and I am quoting from the introduction here. So, dead man walking, how dead? Or perhaps, which is one of the reasons people should read the book, what is the process of revitalization given the enormity of the economic and political odds that the organized labor movement faces?
I think that labor needs to do several things, but probably the most important is this. People know that We're in really tough economic times. They don't need to be told that. They know that 3 million jobs, manufacturing jobs, have gone overseas this decade alone. They know that workers who've often made wage concessions for years and years to get good pensions are retiring and not getting those pensions. They know that millions of people don't have health care. They know there's growing economic insecurity. For the first time in the last couple of years in American history, most Americans don't think their kids will do as well as they've done. So we know that's happening. Then on the other hand, we see this decline, initially gradual, recently precipitous, of labor. By recently, I mean post-1980, 81. And people think, well, the second phenomena is sort of irrelevant, inconsequential, in any case, inevitable. And they don't draw the connection between what's happening to ordinary people and working class people on the one hand, and on the other hand, what's happening to the very institution that's supposed to serve and protect and defend their interests. And I argue in the book that it's no coincidence that this assault, both economic and politically in terms of workplace rights, is happening at the very time labor has been weakened, any more than it was a coincidence that the time of labor's greatest strength from the late 40s to the mid-70s was also the biggest expansion of the middle class in our history. So the first thing I think people in labor need to do is let people know why labor matters, and not just to the 12% of workers in unions, not just to workers in general, but to the country as a whole. We can get into that a little more if you'd like. So that's communication. The other things I think labor needs to do are put the rank and file forward. Every instance I've covered where labor really succeeded on any field, be it collective bargaining, politics, organizing, it wasn't because of brilliant strategies from brilliant labor leaders. It was because those labor leaders were smart enough to put the rank and file workers forward, make them the story. I think labor needs to stress its values. Third thing, in terms of election, I said a minute ago, I think unions spent too much time electing candidate X and not putting forth their values. And I say values on purpose, not just issues. I did a lot of reporting from Ohio and Pennsylvania before the 2004 election. And I was just startled by the way. I was in a Bush headquarters one day in Canton, Ohio, and this nice young woman in her 30s, Sue Williams, was calling Republican voters, prospective voters at home, and mostly leaving messages because they were out during the day. And she was saying, she put aside her script and she said, "This is Sue Williams, and I just want to remind you that a vote for the president is a vote for God." And that's all she needed to say, because for days, weeks, months, years, the groundwork had been laid by conservatives about social values. Meanwhile, to counterbalance that, you know, the Democrats were flying in young people from San Francisco and L.A. to Ohio a week before the election who could barely pronounce the streets that they were canvassing on. And I wondered then, I wonder now, and I talk about this in the book, who is more respected in a community than firefighters and teachers and nurses and cops and laborers and so on? Where were they talking about their values? Because I think it's every bit as much a value to get that pension you were promised for decades or to have health care for your family as it is to stop two gays from marrying. But why does labor and why do Democrats allow the so-called Reagan Dems or blue-collar conservatives to find themselves in the position where they're juxtaposing their, quote, values and their economic interests? Because doing it that way makes economic interests seem selfish and small. And the fourth thing, aside from the ones I've just mentioned, is the issue of strategies. I found in too many instances, again, be it in organizing or politics or collective bargaining, labor sort of pulls a generic playbook off the shelf and says, this is what we've done in the past, let's do it again. In each case I've covered, whether it was 900 poor black women in the Mississippi Delta who, against all odds, won an amazing victory against a wealthy white company, or the firefighters in Iowa. And incidentally, the dead man walking really referred to John Kerry.
I know.
Because he was. And the firefighters alone, basically not only battling the other candidates with way more money and standing in the polls, but also the rest of the labor movement, won the caucus for him, then won New Hampshire for him, and basically got him the nomination simply because they had an incredible strategy. So those are some of the things I think labor needs to do.
I've always wondered why labor doesn't use some of the same kind of mobilization that they do during political campaigns, the phone banks, the literature, the amount of effort that goes into the political campaigns for the Democrats for our own issues, for either labor struggles or for political issues. Do you think that that makes some kind of sense either during the political campaign or in out years?
Put your finger on a big part of my book is that I think is labor's probably the most important thing labor could do before the split in labor in the fall of 05. In the fall of 04, there were some major meetings around the country and for about a period of a year, and one of them was in New York, called Labor at the Crossroads, and they were wrestling with what do we do to revive ourselves, because they're finally, belatedly acknowledged, we're really in trouble. We need to get real here and try to, you know, save ourselves. Unfortunately, they came up with a bunch of sort of dusty and, I think, unrealizable goals. Let's organize, or let's focus on politics, or let's represent members better, or let's do better collective bargaining. They couldn't do any one of those because they're in a catch-22. They couldn't organize because they can't change labor laws that would make it fair. They can't change labor laws because they can't win elections, because they can't get enough members. I mean, it's just a vicious cycle downward. And I think they need to do exactly what you just said, which is step out of that box and let the country know why it's in everybody's best interest, why labor is still relevant. One reason we've had a really good economy for a long time in this country is that we've had a robust bipartite industrial relations system where unions, where government, where management are all represented and voice the concerns of their constituents. Labor may not always win, but at least they're at the table. And out of that rigorous debate, you get the best public policies and corporate practices. Right now, we've got a skewed labor relations system. We've got unbalanced policies. And that's why we have these things that everyone's complaining about, the job flight, the economic insecurity. So for the country to function well in our economy, we need everybody at the table, and we need a vibrant labor movement.
I can't help but think that one of the things that I've long wanted labor to get immersed in, and when they do, they are effective, and that is the, shall we call it, the consumer or the community sphere, if you will, the issues of Social Security, the issues of the health care system, things that are fundamental to the way people live their lives, indeed issues of civil liberties and human rights. There's a timidity and a reticence to get involved in that. But I want you to give also a sense of one of the things that you've already mentioned but fleshed out more, and that was the wonderful, wonderful segment in the book and what Ken and I have had some experience with, and that is the women of Delta Pride, the catfish workers. The energy and the effort that was put into place there was just such a source of encouragement. And since we've mentioned some of the problematic and negative things, mm-hmm. I think you do so beautifully dealing with groups like that and specifically them in the book.
Well, I appreciate that. And that was really a rewarding thing to cover initially as a reporter and then to remember and reflect on and write about now. This was a case where 900 impoverished black women, against all odds, went out and strike against the biggest catfish company in the world on the Mississippi Delta. So not only Mississippi, a viciously anti-union state, but a part of the state where the basic civil rights movement had skipped over. And there was double-digit black unemployment, and they were untrained. They had really no other jobs. But as they told me, if we don't fight now, we're going to be working for nothing. We'll be slaves all our lives. This is a plantation mentality moved inside. I can't help thinking that the cotton fields, it's the same thing. Because these women had decades earlier, a lot of them worked on cotton fields, on plantations. And this was not a fight about just about wages and benefits, although they were paid basically poverty wages. They were in their 20s and they're getting carpal tunnel syndrome because they did repetitive motions 8 hours a day, you know, delunging, beheading, freezing, filleting, everything to do with catfish. They were allowed 5 bathroom visits a week, each one 5 minutes long, accompanied by a supervisor, and that included the walk outside to the outhouse and the walk back in, and anything more than that, they were written up. They had just been represented by the UFCW, United Food and Commercial Workers, local in Memphis, and these catfish farmers, wealthy white farmers, 160 of them, didn't exactly like the notion of, you know, as they said, this is our labor, these are our workers, we don't understand the notion of somebody else telling us how we can use our workers. So they went out on strike, and not only was there that power imbalance, but the whole establishment of the town was on the, for example, the mayor of the town was the firm's attorney. The owners of the firm were on the board of directors of the banks that owned the women's mortgages and said, if you go out on strike, we don't see how you're going to pay your mortgage and keep your house. So one day I'm sitting in St. Louis, and the UFCW calls me, and in Washington says this is a great strike by, you know, as I just described, got all, everything you're interested in, race, gender, social drama, but nobody's covering it. And they didn't call me because they think I'm the greatest reporter in the country or was their best friend. They called me because they actually were thinking strategically. They knew down the road they might have to, given that power imbalance, resort to, for instance, a boycott. And St. Louis is a place where a lot of black Mississippians migrate. It's a place that eats 1 million pounds of catfish a year, way more than in bigger places like L.A. or Manhattan. For a variety of reasons, they knew that St. Louis would be key to them, so they called me. They were also unusual in that they had a real communication strategy, and that was part of their overall strategy. You know, the women subsisted on $50 bags of beans and rice every 2 weeks during the fall and the winter. It was getting cold out. As soon as they announced a boycott, I wrote about it. St. Louis, because they're all family-owned supermarkets, didn't want to be embarrassed with the public or with UFCW local in St. Louis, which is the biggest union there, for a whole lot of reasons. The day the boycott was announced, every store in St. Louis stopped selling Delta Pride catfish. 3 months later, Christmas Eve, they voted in a small black church, 473-1, to accept a contract that doubled their wages, got rid of the owner's conditions like the bathroom visits, gave them breaks, gave them medical visits.
Philip, we're going to have to leave it there. But to complete the story, guess what? You've got to get the book, State of the Unions, How Labor Can Strengthen the Middle Class, Improve Our Economy, and Regain Political Influence by Philip M. Dime, and it really is a compelling tale, and it's beautifully, beautifully written.
They used to tell me I was building a dream. So I followed the mark. When there was earth to plow, all guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in this line waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run. Made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and time. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
And Yip Harburg's Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? Was sung by Odetta and Dr. John.
And this is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, and we're moving on.
And now, George Carlin may no longer be with us, but his words still pack a punch. We present George Carlin on The American Dream, or Who Owns This Country?
Life is filled with interesting things. That's why I could never commit suicide. I'm having too much fun keeping an eye on you folks, watching what you do. Human behavior, that's what I like. Humans do some really interesting things. Like, besides killing ourselves, we also kill each other. Murder. And we're the only ones who do that, by the way. Humans are the only species on Earth that deliberately kills members of another species for personal gain. Or pleasure. Sometimes it's just fun. We're also the only species that deliberately kills members of another species for personal gain. Or pleasure. That's what hunters do. They kill for pleasure. That's us. Human beings. Interesting folks. Murderers. Here's an interesting form of murder we come up with. Assassination. You know what's interesting about assassination? Well, not only does it change those popularity polls in a big hurry, but it's also interesting to notice who it is we assassinate. Do you ever notice who it is? Stop to think of who it is we kill. It's always people who've told us to live together in harmony and try to love one another. Jesus, Gandhi, Lincoln, John Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, John Lennon. They all said, try to live together peacefully. Bam! Right in the head. Apparently, we're not ready for that. Yeah, that's difficult behavior for us. Not too bright, folks. Not too bright. But if you talk to one of them about this, if you isolate one of them, you sit them down rationally, and you talk to them about the low IQs and the dumb behavior and the bad decisions, right away they start talking about education. That's the big answer to everything. Education. They say, we need more money for education. We need more books, more teachers, more classrooms, more schools. We need more testing for the kids. You say to them, well, you know, we've tried all of that, and the kids still can't pass the test. They say, oh, don't you worry about that. We're going to lower the passing grades. And that's what they do in a lot of these schools now. They lower the passing grades so more kids can pass. More kids pass, the school looks good, everybody's happy, the IQ of the country slips another 2 or 3 points, and pretty soon all you'll need to get into college is a pencil. Got a pencil? Get in there, it's physics. Then everyone wonders why 17 other countries graduate more scientists than we do. Education! Politicians know that word, they use it on you. Politicians have traditionally hidden behind 3 things. The flag, the Bible, and children. No child left behind. No child left behind. Oh, really? Well, it wasn't long ago you were talking about giving kids a head start. Head start, left behind. Someone's losing ground here. But there's a reason. There's a reason. There's a reason for this. And it's the same reason that it will never, ever, ever be fixed. It's never going to get any better. Don't look for it. Be happy with what you got. Because the owners of this country don't want that. I'm talking about the real owners now. The big, the wealthy, that the real owners, the big wealthy business interests that control things and make all the important decisions. Forget the politicians. They're irrelevant. The politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets. And they own all the big media news, all the big media companies, so they control just about all of the news and information you get to hear. They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. You know something? They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table and figure out how badly they're getting f***ed by a system that threw them overboard 30 years ago. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers. People who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your retirement money. They want it back. So they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And you know something? They'll get it. They'll get it all from you sooner or later because they own this place. It's a big club, and you ain't in it. You and I are not in the big club. And by the way, it's the same big club they use to beat you over the head with all day long when they tell you what to believe. All day long, beating you over the head in their media, telling you what to believe, what to think, and what to buy. The table is tilted, folks. The game is rigged, and nobody seems to notice. Nobody seems to care. Good, honest, hardworking people, white collar, blue collar, doesn't matter what color shirt you have on. Good, honest, hardworking people continue. These are people of modest means. Continue to elect these rich. They don't give a about you. They don't care about you at all. At all. At all. Man. You know? And nobody seems to notice. Nobody seems to care. That's what the owners count on. The fact that Americans will probably remain willfully ignorant. Because the owners of this country know the truth. It's called the American dream. Because you have to be asleep to believe it.
I'd like to thank you for listening. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report.
It was Al all the time. Don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare it down? Buddy, can you spare a dime?